solution of this learning problem. And then in the fourth part, which is presumably the most controversial part, I will tell you how we can use could use quantum models to for classical data analysis, meaning for analyzing data that has not been sampled from physical systems. And you may be a bit surprised about this. And as a teaser, I'd like to add this remark saying that we actually are going to observe good performance of quantum models used in data analysis of non-physical data sets. And then finally, I'm going to conclude with also some remarks about future directions. So what is the setting? We are considering experiments allowing for the preparation of states S1 up to S capital X. And we assume that these experiments allow for capital Y many measurements, each of which is described by OY1 up to OY capital C. And the first label here is a label that labels the specific measurement setting. And the second label labels the measurement outcomes. And Y runs from Y up to, from one up to capital Y. So this, this tuple here is a bit like a POVM element, but I, for the moment, I'd like you to think of these symbols S1 up to SX and OY1 up to OY capital C, not in terms of density matrices and POVMs, but rather in terms of instructions an experimentalist can use to reproduce the experiment. So as such, these are not matrices. These are documents, manuals, if you want, that an experimentalist can use to rebuild the experiment. And as such, these instructions can also contain temporal and spatial information. So for example, we could have that SX is an detailed instruction for preparing a superconducting qubit, and OY1 up to OY capital C could be a detailed instruction for building an actual measurement device that can be used for the readout of this superconducting qubit. And what we know phenomenologically about the experiment is given in terms of measurements that we perform on the experiment. So what we do is we start measuring specific states with specific measurements. And by doing so, we collect the numbers P, X, Y, Z, which are equal to the probability for obtaining outcome C, given that we decided to prepare state X and given that we decided to perform the measurement Y on this state X. And we thus collect such numbers P, X, Y, Z for all X, Y, Z in some index set omega, which is a subset of the set from 1 up to capital X times 1 up to capital Y times 1 up to capital C. Yes?
Two questions. Mm-hmm. So the first question is, in the on the left-hand side of that equation, is the conditioning variables always come first, or is this just a fluke of the implementation? So this is probability of Z given X, Y.
Yeah, so you
then on the left-hand side, it's...
Oh, this is just notation. This is just notation. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Second question is, you don't care about... So in the first slide, you had some number of states.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have just one state, then this would be like tomography, but you don't care about the number of copies.
Actually, if you just have one state, then the whole problem becomes trivial. So if you already know a bit what I'm going to talk about. So if you have just one state and you want to infer states and measurements being compatible with just one state, then there is always a one-dimensional quantum model where you just assign the probabilities that you measure, where you assign the number one to the as the state, as a density matrix, a one-by-one matrix, and where you assign the probabilities to the POVM element. So the simplest quantum model reproducing these statistics is actually one-dimensional only.
But you also don't care about finite samples?
I'm going to consider uncertainties in the measurement data, but not statements of the form. If you repeat this experiment n times, then you get these and these properties.
So,
X is the label of the state. So that's right, yeah. Mm-hmm. So coming back to notation from before, this would be would mean outcome OYZ given that we prepare state SX and given that it was measured. Yeah. Yeah, and for simplicity, we assume that we can repeat this measurement an arbitrary number of times so that we get an arbitrary good approximation of the underlying probability.
But you don't estimate any sort of implicit statistical procedures of stating this as a probability. It's just like if actually someone would try to go with this framework and do something in laboratory, then in order to deal with this thing as more or less logic probability, usually some additional assumption on the way how this repetitivity should be dealt with.
Yes. You know what I mean? Like the reproducibility of specific frequency and so on.
Are you referring to the question whether we can always prepare the same state? Or?
My question is here, okay, I think that I can move it to the questions time.
Okay,
but it's not relevant right now.
Okay, so to come back to this, this just says that all the phenomenological data that we have available about the system is in terms of numbers PXYZ for XYZ in some index set omega, which is a subset of all states times all measurement settings times outcomes per measurements. And now to interpret this phenomenological data quantumly, what we want to do is we want to take this phenomenological knowledge that we have about the experiment, and we want to translate these descriptions, these verbose descriptions of the setup and of the state, and we want to map these descriptions to density matrices rho x, and we want to take these descriptions of the measurement devices and we want to map them to POVMs. And we want to do that in a way that is compatible with the data that we have measured. So we want to have this this constraint here that we want to have that phrase rho x times EYZ is equal to PXYZ for all XYZ in omega. And if we manage to find such an assignment, then we call the density matrices rho x and the POVM elements EYZ a quantum model for the data PXYZ with XYZ in omega. Is that part clear? This is kind of important for all what is common. Please ask questions if these notions are clear.
Given data, can we uniquely specify the model?
Not always, no. Sometimes you have something like gauge degrees of freedom, where you can. It's not, no, the density matrices and POVM elements are not always unique. Especially if we go to the lowest dimension. If you don't have dimension restrictions, then certainly not.
Is this subtlety important?
This is not a subtlety. I think this is important. Okay, so this is what I mean by quantum model. Now we should ask: Is this a difficult problem? Is it difficult to find density matrices and POVM elements such that this is satisfied? And the answer is no. It is actually there is a trivial solution to this problem. And to see why, I denote by ket x, x running from 1 up to the total number of states, the canonical basis in the vector space Cx. And then if we set rho x equal to the one-dimensional projector onto the direction x, and if we set Eyz equal to the sum over x such that xyz is an omega, pxyz times the projector onto the direction x, plus x summation over x such that xyz is not in omega, Kronecker c1 times the projector onto the direction x, then indeed we have that the phrase rho x eyz is equal to pxyz for all xyz in omega. So we, in other words, this Ansatz model perfectly fits the data. However, we have that for all xyz that is not contained in the set omega that marks the measured parent between states and measurements. For all these x, y, z's, we have that the model predicts that we are going to measure outcome z with certainty one, with probability one. this choice that we're going to measure, that we're going to predict outcome one, is actually an arbitrary choice. We could have put in something else here. In other words, we have a model that perfectly fits the data but has absolutely no predictive power. And this phenomenon, perfect fit on the one side but no poor predictive power, is captured by the term overfitting. So this is an example of a model that overfits the data. And why was this possible? This was possible because we scaled the complexity of the model that we want to fit to the data with the size of the data set. This is apparent here. So we, the Hilbert space dimension grows with the number, total number of states that we use in the experiment. So we scale the, so what we did, we scaled the complexity of the model with the size of the data sets, and we did this too quickly, and this led to fitting the data to the model. And to prohibit this, we want to find, now we should try to find the quantum model with lowest complexity that reproduces the data set. And this leads to an optimization problem that I call min-din. And in this optimization problem, we want to find the minimal dimension d. The dimension is always coupled to the number of degrees of freedom in the quantum model. We want to find the minimal dimension d such that there exists d-dimensional quantum states rho x and d-dimensional quantum measurements e, y, z, with the property that p, x, y, z, the probabilities that we measure, is equal to trace rho x, e, y, z for all x, y, z in this index set over. This is ideally the optimization problem that we would like to solve, and this optimization problem describes the data-driven learning of quantum models. This would be pretty cool if we could solve that. It would be pretty cool because then we would have an algorithm that takes as input measured data and would output a quantum model that describes this this data set in optimal manner.
So, question?
Yeah.
Maybe this is jumping the gun, but if it's a finite data set, so a finite sample, typically I'd expect the dimension would have to be infinite to perfectly fit it. So you're going to
Actually, you can always find it. So this this example here shows that you can always find a finite dimension quantum model. This is different from the two-party set. So if you impose a two-party structure as in Bob, then we have examples of data sets that you cannot fit with finite dimensional quantum models. So the one-party setting is different in that regard.
I guess I'm wondering whether, you know, if you want to move from, you know, dimension equal to the number of different settings to, you know, something much smaller, like two-dimensional, would it make more sense to just require the quantum model, you know, reproduced within epsilon probabilities that you've observed as opposed to an exact? Because it just seems to be that ask for an exact reproduction, your dimension's going to be much closer to this cardinality.
Yeah. So this is, I will partly address this later in the talk, and this is also like finding good approximation algorithms, I think, is a big, it's an important open problem that is worth addressing. So, but in this exact, actually, so in this exact formulation of the problem, we can actually show that this problem is NP-hard. So we cannot have, unless p is equal to np, we cannot have hope to find an efficient algorithm to solve this optimization problem. And this is proven in this recent preprint, and the proof proceeds via reduction from three color.
So np hard, so it's not in np. Or it's not, obviously.
If you formulated it in over finite fields, it would be an NP. Because you can, if someone gives you a proof, then you can just this is in some sense bad news, but I guess also not too surprising that this problem is NP hard. So this is like the one party version, but there's a closely related. Yeah, please.
Is it NP hard when you just when you scale the data table?
Yes.
Yep. So even if I have a promise that there's a solution with some in dimension three or something, is it still NP hard? As the
actually checking whether there is a three dimensional model is already NP hard. So the size of the problem is measured in terms of the minimum of x and y, so the number of states and number of measures. Yep. So this is the problem min din, and there's a closely related relative of min din, which is the natural two-party version, where we consider two parties, Alice and Bob, and these two parties, they share a quantum state and perform measurements on each of their sides. And I call this problem min din AB. And in this optimization problem, we want to find the minimal dimension D such that there exists a D squared dimensional shared quantum state rho, and D dimensional measurements EYZ and FYZ such that the PYZ Y prime Z prime is equal to trace rho times EYZ tensor FY prime Z prime for all YZ Y prime Z prime that we measure experimentally. And yeah.
I have a question regarding like those both ansatzes, how to say it. Because like here you argued like the dimensionality, like when we extend this dimensionality is like there is this effect of overfitting, so the natural way would be to reduce dimensionality. However, on the other hand, the question is like, do we really want to reproduce probabilities strictly? And I would expect that the kind of more robust problem to solve would be actually something like a mixture of reducing dimensionality and also trying to not get precise probabilities, but only probabilities in a certain way defined closely to the. So, like, I think that those problems kind of could be.
I mean, this is only one formulation of the problem, and in this exact formulation, it is NP-hard. It's an open problem to extend this result to some approximation. That's what it is. But in this exact setting where we hypothesize that we can repeat the measurements an arbitrary number of times, then it's. Now we have this. I briefly mentioned what this problem Mindy may be is. And there again, in its exact formulation of the problem, it is also NP-hard. This is proven in the same paper, and the proof always also proceeds via reduction from free polynomial. Okay, so we have these results about NP-hardness, and this leads to some obvious questions, and you already raised them basically. So, what about approximations? Can we have efficient approximation algorithms with some approximation guarantees? And related is the question about the robustness of the solution. How does the dimension, the minimal dimension, behave under uncertainties in the empirical data? I'm not going to talk about this, but I'm going to address this point in the next part of the talk. And then as a third problem, I think it's important to notice that if we want to address all possible situations as before, then the problem is NP-hard. But if we restrict our attention to some subsets of data tables, then the problem can become easy to solve. So I think it would be important to illuminate kind of this trade-off that we have between the size of the class of data tables that we consider and the computational complexity to infer the underlying quantum model. So if we restrict our attention to some specific classes of data tables, then suddenly the problem can become much easier. So I think the challenge is to find classes of data tables that are relevant in practice and allow for efficient inference. And then lastly, I think because this problem is well motivated by the analysis of quantum experiments, namely systematic errors that are a bottleneck for today's quantum experiments, I think it's worth spending some time into designing heuristic algorithms to address this problem. And we have some results in that direction. Alright, so now let me mention some related work. Obviously there have been many, many people thinking about this problem since it's so basic. Let me just mention some representative works. So related to MinDim and MinDim AB, we have work by Scott Aronson and others where they derived the rank of a data table as a lower bound of the dimension of the quantum model, the minimum quantum model. We have work by Stephanie Rehner and others that also derive lower bounds in terms of random access code. We have works aiming for linear dimension witnesses by Antonio Assi, Nicola Bruhn, Carrego. And we have other works aiming for using SDP hierarchies to compute the low dimensional quantum. So this is the first group of works, and we have another group of works where that's not the modification of min-dim, where we assume that the states, the experimental states and the experimental measurements are such that they are created from some reference states by the application of sequences of gates. And here we have works by people from IBM. We have work by Blume Kohut, where he introduces gate set tomography. We have work by Shelby Kimmel, who uses, and others, who uses techniques from randomized benchmarking to infer, partially infer quantum models. We have work from people here about randomized benchmarking. Of course, there are many other papers about that too. We have a work by Andreas Winter that studies the more mathematical side of things and not so much algorithms. And we have a recent review about gate set tomography by Jackson and Fanny. And finally, I'd like to mention a third group of works about extension complexity, which I'm not going to really talk about here, but let me assure you that extension complexity is a notion that characterizes the optimal semi-definite programming representation of linear convex linear optimization problems. And extension complexity is related to PSD rank and PSD factorizations, and PSD factorizations are very closely related to quantum models. So there is an intimate connection between what we study here and this notion from mathematical programming. And therefore, I'd like to point out these works as well. Okay, so now let me go to the next part of the talk, where we talk about the robustness, so the behavior of the minimal, the optimal quantum model under when we tolerate some errors in fitting the data, or where we assume that we have some uncertainty. And then we begin with the following observation, just an empirical observation, namely that for many quantum systems that we consider in the lab, we oftentimes can find low-dimensional quantum models to describe them. And we can do this despite the fact that these systems are intrinsically high-dimensional. They're complex, they're very complex systems. But still we can find these simple models, and this may or may not suggest that the dimension of the lowest dimensional quantum representation of the data is not robust, meaning it can shrink dramatically if we tolerate some errors. Or in other words, this may suggest that for all high-dimensional quantum models of dimension capital D, there exists a low-dimensional quantum model in terms of rho x prime and dyz prime, with the property that the inner products between states and measurements are approximately preserved. Or put differently, we could expect that for all high-dimensional quantum models can be compressed into low-dimensional quantum models while approximately preserving the inner products between states and measurements. But is this true? Is this actually the case? And the answer is no, not always, at least. And this is a simple consequence of a very short calculation, where we start with the observation that trace rho x EYC is upper bounded by the operator norm of rho x times the trace norm of EYZ, which in turn is upper bounded by the trace of EYZ because the eigenvalues of a density matrix is are upper bounded by 1. So we have this lower bounded also for all x. So we can consider max over x trace rho x EYZ as a lower bound on trace EYZ. And now we can sum over all measurement outcomes, C, to get the lower bound, sum over C max over X trace rho X EYZ is a lower bound on sum over C trace EYZ. Now we can take the sum into the trace, and we can use the normalization condition for PRDMs to get that this is equal to the trace of the identity matrix, and the trace of the identity matrix is equal to the dimension of every possible quantum representation of the data given in terms of these inner. So we have a lower, in other words, we have a lower bound on the dimension of every possible quantum representation of the measured data. And this is a lower bound that has been found independently by Lee, Y, and De Wolf. All right, so now let's see what this lower bound can give us. It's easy to come up with examples for quantum models where max over x trace to x EYC is equal to 1 for all c. And in these settings, we then get the lower bound capital C, the number of measurement outcomes is a lower bound on the dimension of every possible quantum representation. We can make this robust. Also. In other words, we notice that it can happen that the number, the total number of measurement outcomes presents a barrier for compressibility, or it can support, in other words, it can support robustness of the dimension. And in another observation, and I'm not going to go into the details here, but in a separate observation, we observed that we can compress positive semi-definite factorizations. We can compress them exponentially. If we tolerate the compression error that scales with the trace of the POVM elements, and the trace of the POVM element is a well-known surrogate for the rank of the POVM. So in other words, it seems that the large number of measurement outcomes and large ranks of POVM elements can prohibit compression of quantum models. And this motivates looking at the opposite regime, basically. This motivates having us paying more attention to the class of quantum models that does not satisfy any of these conditions. And we call this class of models pseudo-low rank. In other words, meaning we call a quantum model in terms of density matrices rho x and POVM elements EYC pseudo-low rank if c is small, or more precisely constant in the original dimension, and if all but one of the POVM elements are low rank, or more precisely constant in the dimension. So this class of models is constructed, is defined so that you are not violating any of these things here. And now we can ask, is this class of models compressible? And I claim also that this is a relevant class because, for instance, if we measure whether or not we are in the ground state energy, then this is a binary measurement where we satisfies these conditions. It's just one example. And now we can ask whether this class of models is compressible, and the answer is indeed yes. So we get the following theorem, which reads as follows. Let J be equal to the total number of states plus the total number of measurements times the total number of outcomes. Let small d be of the order of 1 over epsilon squared times the logarithm of 4JB. And let the rho x EYC be of pseudo-low rank, a model, a quantum model which is pseudo-low rank. And then the theorem says that there exists density matrices rho x prime in POVM elements EYC prime, which are small dimensional, with the property that the absolute value of trace rho x times EYC minus trace rho x prime EYC prime is of the order of epsilon. In other words, the theorem says that models which are pseudo-low rank can be compressed exponentially. And the proof goes via the analysis of an explicit compression scheme that can be found in a paper by myself and Aaron Harrell. And this result forms a generalization of a result by Andreas Winter, which was specific to rank 1 measurements and which achieved quadratic compression. And this result has obviously applications in the learning of quantum models, but through the intimate connection between the learning of quantum models and communication complexity and extension complexity, we automatically get implications in these two areas, communication complexity, a discipline in theoretical computer science, and extension complexity, which is a discipline in mathematical programming. I think it was a question.
My original question was explained by this theorem, but I have another one. How often, like if I would just try to propose some model, how often it would be like pseudo-low rank? Like what is the, you know, actually, surveillance of their along.
Like, yeah, so I think a very practical example is really the question whether whether you perform binary measurements asking the system, are you in the ground state energy, are you in the first excited energy state, or in the second excited energy state, and so on. So if the energy levels are non-degenerate, then all of these are pseudo-Lorentz measurements. So if you, for instance, if you have measurements like this, where you ask questions of that type, then these are always pseudo-Lorentz.
So, for example, like just thinking about like some experiments, like if I have some setup with detectors, would it be pseudo-Lorentz type situation or not?
Well, I guess first you to answer the question, you first need an explicit model. So pseudo-Lorentz is a property of density matrices in PLVM elements. So first you need to have a model of your detectors, and then you can look at these density matrices and PLVM elements to see whether is pseudo-Lorentz. But actually, this kind of interesting. I think it's kind of interesting that if you look at an energy measurement. If you assume that all of the energy levels are non-degenerate, then this energy measurement is not pseudo-Lorentz because we have many rank one measurements. So if, as many rank one measurements as the Hilbert space dimension. But if we now reinterpret this data in terms of a bunch of binary measurements, so if we, instead of asking the system, what is your energy, we ask the system, are you in ground state energy? Are you in the first excited energy? Are you in the second excited energy energy state, and so on? Then the situation suddenly becomes compressible. So there is a difference.
So, but this means that it's actually this change. It's not a just change of basis. It's like reinterpreting the,
yes,
experimental situation.
You reinterpret the distribution, yes. Mm-hmm. But it actually makes a dramatic difference from the perspective of compressibility.
This is interesting.
Okay, so this is all I wanted to say about the robustness for now. And now we come to the fourth part of the talk, which is about the application of quantum models in the context of general data analysis, meaning data analysis of data sets that have not been sampled from physical systems. This is presumably the most controversial part now. We want to analyze non-physical data sets through quantum models. And to be more precise, we consider the problem of movie recommendation, which is an example for item recommendation. Item recommendation is a key discipline in machine learning. So what is it about? What is movie recommendation? In movie recommendation, we imagine that we run a platform like Amazon or Netflix, let's say Netflix. And on this platform, we offer a bunch of movies for streaming. So for instance, we could offer Jurassic Park, Despicable Me, Airplane, Notting Hill, and many other more movies. And hopefully, we also have some customers, some users of our platform. Let's call them Alice, Bob, Charlie, Donald, and so on. And these users, they start watching movies, and occasionally we ask them to rate, to provide ratings of movies. Ask them whether they like or dislike the movie. And sometimes these users provide ratings for movies, and we end up with data sets that could look like this. So we have, for the user Alice, we have that she doesn't like Jurassic Park, she really likes Despicable Me, she pretty much likes Airplane, and kind of likes Notting Hill. And we have another user, Bob, which likes Jurassic Park, likes Despicable Me, has not yet seen or just not rated Airplane, and dislikes Notting Hill. Then you have Charlie, which has not yet seen or not rated Jurassic Park, kind of likes Despicable Me, kind of likes Airplane, kind of likes Notting Hill. And Donald has only seen Notting Hill and really liked it. Now, this is the data that we collect, and now we want to analyze this data. And algorithms to analyze data sets of this form are called recommender systems. And recommender systems should satisfy a bunch of criteria. Good recommender systems should satisfy a bunch of criteria. So for one, on the one side, they should have high predictive power. So they should be able to predict what the rating will be once Bob decides to rate Airplane. And they should, these algorithms should have high predictive power despite the data being very sparse and very noisy. Secondly, recommender system should be computationally tractable. We should be able to make predictions, we should be able to analyze the data despite very, very large numbers of movies and very, very large numbers of users. So we can have millions of users. And lastly, ideally we would like to have a recommender system that computes user representations and item representations that are highly interpretable so that we can get feedback to the user saying what we think his or her preferences are, and so that we can succinctly summarize properties of this large pool of users and large pool of items. And okay, we want to address all of these properties in terms of a paradigm which you might call system-state measurement paradigm, where the system is that abstract part of our thinking that determines whether or not we like a movie. The state specifies the explicit manifestation of the system, namely the state that specifies the individual preferences of the users. And the measurements are questions like, do you like item I? So no, or do you like how many stars do you give or movie I? And we propose to adopt this paradigm in terms of quantum models, meaning that we want to solve min dim for this data set. Just to remind you that this is the problem of finding the minimal dimension d such that there exists d-dimensional states rho u for each user u, and such that there exists measurements e I z for each item I, with the property that trace rho u EIC approximates the deterministic distribution that is supported on the provided rating RUI, user u provides for item I. And so this is the model, this is the optimization problem we would like to address. And before we talk about actually addressing this optimization problem, we may ask another question, maybe whether we can even have hope to find low-dimensional quantum models for real-world data sets. Is it even possible to find quantum models that describe data sets that have not been sampled from physical systems? If the answer is no, then we should stop here and we shouldn't even continue analyzing this approach, if we're not even able to find quantum models describing low-dimensional quantum models describing real-world data sets that have no explicit physical properties. And to answer this question, let me first start with an observation about real-world data sets. So real-world data sets are typically very, very sparse. So we only know very few ratings, say, of users for items. So here are some examples of data sets that are used for the evaluation of practical recommender systems. We have the Duban dataset, which is about movies, and this dataset contains roughly 130,000 users and roughly 60,000 items. So capital U is the number of users and capital I is the number of items. And the density of ratings is 0.22%. And then we have other datasets of opinions, which is about cars, books, and many other products. We have the Flixster dataset, which is about movies, a newer dataset, FilmTrust, which is about movies. And then we have the famous datasets MovieLens and Netflix, which are both about movies. And we recognize that the density of ratings for each of these datasets is roughly a percent, around a percent. But this is actually still far too optimistic, because many of these datasets, or at least the MovieLens dataset, that I know it for sure, are constructed in a way that we only add users to this dataset if the user has rated a minimal number of movies. So I think for the MovieLens dataset, a user needs to have rated at least 20 movies before the user is added to the dataset. So these datasets are artificially dense. Usually they're actually more sparse. Okay, so if we accept this observation that most real-world datasets are very sparse, we can reformulate the previous question whether or not it's possible to find low-dimensional quantum models for real-world datasets in the form, are there low-dimensional quantum models for sparse datasets? If there are low-dimensional quantum models for sparse datasets, then certainly we get as an implication that there are low-dimensional quantum models for real-world datasets if the real-world datasets are sparse. And the answer is yes. Actually, we have low-dimensional quantum models for sparse datasets. This is the statement of this theorem. It says the following: let J be equal to the total number of users plus the total number of items times the number of ratings per item. We assume that the number of ratings per item is constant in the number of users. This is how we capture sparsity. And then the theorem says that for small d of the order of 1 over epsilon squared times the logarithm of 4JU, there exists a small d-dimensional quantum model in terms of rho x and dyc with the property that the absolute value of Kronecker C and the provided rating of user u for item I minus the probability predicted by the quantum model is of the order epsilon. And this holds true for all observations in the index at all C. So in other words, if we have a sparse data sets with sparsity defined in this manner, then we can find a low-dimensional quantum model, low-dimensional meaning logarithmic in 4G. And the proof of this theorem proceeds via the compression of a trivial quantum model. And this trivial quantum model has no predictive power by itself. So obviously, the compression of this trivial quantum model has no predictive power either. And in this sense, we have again the situation that we have low-dimensional quantum models that fit the data well but have no predictive power. So this is another example for the phenomenon overfitting. And we can now have basically draw two conclusions. On the one hand, we have the observation that we can find low-dimensional quantum model for real-world data sets that have no physical nature. On the other hand, this result says that it's very easy to overfit sparse data in terms of with quantum models. So the second part, I think, is a lesson for physics. It says that we shouldn't be surprised if we can find a low-dimensional quantum model describing physical experiments if the data set is sparse. This shouldn't be surprising because this is just generically the case. And we shouldn't even be surprised to find low-dimensional quantum models if the states are pure, because this construction leads to pure states. All right, so now we know that it seems possible to find low-dimensional quantum models for sparse data sets, but why should we care? Why should we go quantum? And how can we convince engineers in machine learning to actually use quantum models? And in this preprint that is not out yet, I am going to provide three arguments for why these people may care about quantum models. The first argument is based on numerical evaluation. So we just download a data set, like the movie lens data set, fit quantum models to these data sets, and evaluate their properties. A second argument is based on the observation that the quantum models represent practical relaxations of the compressions of classical models. So, and I think we care about classical models. Classical models are basically nothing else than probabilistic models. So if you care about probabilistic models, then quantum models can be interpreted as relaxations of compressions of very, very high dimensional classical models, which are by themselves cannot be computed because they're just too complex. And as a third point, I explain how we can take quantum models and extract hierarchical orderings of properties of items and users through quantum models. So this is useful if you want to succinctly characterize the pool of users and the pool of items. But I won't talk now about these two points here. I will focus on the practical side of things, the empirical observations. So in the remainder of the talk, I will talk about the evaluation of predictive power of quantum models in the context of general data analysis. And I want to make the claim that quantum models are good in predicting unknown entries at the data table. And I want to make the claim that quantum models are better at predicting unknown entries than other models are. So I want to make, but how do we decide this? How do we decide whether a model A is more predictive than model B? How can there's a well accepted solution to resolving this question, and this is daily bread and butter for people in data analysis. The solution proceeds in four steps. In the first step, we decide on a distance measure between the predictions that the model makes and ground truth. In the second step, we split the available data into two parts. We split it into a training data set and a test. And then in the third part, we use the data from the training set to compute or train the models A and B. And in the fourth part, we simply compare the distance between the prediction of model A and ground truth with the distance of between the prediction of B and ground truth. And if the distance for A is smaller than the distance for B, then we say model A has higher predictive power than model B.
That's on the test set?
Pardon?
That final evaluation is done on the test set?
Yes. Mm-hmm. So we pretend we don't know the test set and just use the training set. And then we make predictions on the test set and see which one works. Okay, so we want to run this, we want to go through these four steps. And for doing so, we need to agree on a distance measure between the prediction and ground truth. And I think the most important distance measures are these three here. So we have a mean average error, which is basically just an L1 distance between prediction and truth. We have root mean squared error, which is basically just an L2 distance. And as such, these two error measures are very geometrical in nature. And we have the third distance measure is, on the other hand, is very operational. It's called recall at end, and it is defined through the application of recommender systems. And I will sketch its definition on the next slide. But before doing so, I'd like to stress that since root mean squared error is an L2 distance, it is very sensitive to outliers. It's much more sensitive to outliers in the comparison between prediction and truth than mean average error is. And I think this strongly supports the claim that the mean average error is the more useful, more meaningful error measure, because all the models that we compute for the data are anyways very much simplified, and we should tolerate outliers in the predictions. So what is recall at n? Recall at n is defined through the is motivated through the application of recommender systems. So let me sketch the application and what recommender systems do. So in practice, recommender systems should compute, for each user, they should compute a short list of recommendations of movies, say. And I call this list of recommendations LN. LN is a list of N items that hopefully the user will like. So this is computed by the recommender system, and then this list is shown to the user. And we call such a list of recommendations a success if this list contains a movie or an item that the user U likes. And then roughly speaking, recall at N approximates the probability for the list LN to be a success. So the list of length N to be a success for the user. This is not the precise definition. The precise definition is kind of lengthy, and I don't want to go through it. But this is kind of the idea. So, okay, so now we know what the mean average error is, we know what root mean squared error is, and we know what we call the n is. So now we can finally actually look how these models perform. And we evaluated the quantum, the performance of quantum models on these famous data sets, MovieLens 100K and MovieLens 1 million. MovieLens 100K contains 943 users and roughly 1,600 movies, and it contains 100,000 ratings users provide for the movies. And the ratings are in terms of 5-star ratings. This is the first data set. The second data set is larger. It contains roughly 6,000 users and roughly 3,700 movies. And it contains roughly 1 million ratings, also in terms of 5-star ratings. Okay, now we can now download these data sets. They are available on the web. And we can start fitting quantum models to these data sets. And for this, as a workhorse, we use alternating optimization. And this is what we get. So these are the results in terms of mean average error and root mean squared error. I show the results for recall at n on the next slide. So the first two columns describe the results for the 100K data set, and the third and the fourth column are reserved for the 1 million data set. We compare the performance of quantum models with state-of-the-art recommender systems. This is a user k nearest neighbor, item k nearest neighbor, non-negative matrix factorization, which is closely related to classical models, and SVD plus, which is basically a low rank completion adapted to this setting. And so we see that the quantum models perform well in mean average error. They outperform these recommender systems here. And they don't do so well. They perform pretty poorly in root mean squared error. But then again, I would claim that mean average error is more relevant because it's the error measure that is robust towards outliers. So this is the picture for both data sets. So mean average error we do well. In root mean squared error we don't do so well. And now recall at n. So in this table, small numbers are good, big numbers are bad. This is different for recall at n. Recall at n, large numbers are good because these are the probabilities of success. On the x-axis, we have n, meaning the length of the list of recommendations. And on the y-axis, we have recall, the probability of success. And these curves capture recall at n for different models. And again, we see that the quantum models perform really well, especially for short lists of recommendations. And short lists of recommendations are the ones that we are mostly interested in, because we don't want to hand to the user very long lists of recommendations, because the user might get bored looking through very long lists of recommendations. And these blue curves actually corresponds to a 12-dimensional. Okay, so this is all I wanted to say about this presumably more controversial side of things. Let me conclude. I'd like to conclude. So we considered the problem of learning quantum models. I've shown to you that this problem needs exact formulation, this NP-hard. We have seen that some quantum models are robust. The dimension of some quantum models is robust. Towards measurement, towards uncertainties in the empirical data, whereas a distinguished class of quantum models, the class of models which we call pseudo low rank, is exponentially compressible. Then we considered the application of quantum models in the context of general data analysis, and the results that we observe are quite encouraging. We definitely want to pursue this direction. And what are some natural directions for future work? So certainly, the algorithms that we use for fitting quantum models to data sets are very primitive. So there is certainly a lot of room for improvements. Maybe we can even get some theoretical guarantees in terms of nets or SCP hierarchies, this might be hard, but maybe also we can just evaluate them. Moreover, I've shown you empirical evidence that quantum models might be useful for general data analysis. And I've presented to you results in terms of the two MovieLens datasets. But it would be, I think it would be important to consider other datasets, fit quantum models to many more empirical data and see how they perform there to get more solid empirical, more solid empirical support for why using quantum models might be useful in practice. I've only mentioned this briefly that we can make use of the structure of quantum models, the user and item representations in quantum models, by extracting hierarchical structures of properties of items and users. But I think there may be many better answers for how to use the structure of quantum models to convince engineers for why we can use quantum models to get better insights into the data. And with this, I'd like to thank you for your attention. Yes?
So if I understood correctly, you've shown that for existing classical models, in particular for that third figure of merit, you show the quantum model outperforms those. So all the ones you're comparing it to were
the
various classical algorithms. Like, it actually, go to the next slide. This is the best performance of the quantum model. But that doesn't establish that there couldn't be some classical model which does better than the quantum model.
Absolutely.
So I have an intuition as to why that should be the case, and I'm just curious what you think about it. So why should any what you call system state measurement paradigm work as a recommendation system? I would say the intuition is this, that what determines people's movie preferences, for example, is what their psychological state is. And there's some, you know, fixed number of psychological states which are very good at predicting movie preferences. And so people's actual recommendations give you a probability distribution for Alice over, you know, what's my beliefs about her likely psychological state, and similarly for every other user. And then for every psychological state, I can make predictions about what they're likely to like and not like. And so I can imagine a PSD decomposition of the sparse matrix of movie preferences for users that makes sense as a story as to what's actually going on when people rate movies. But unless I think there's some sort of, you know, quantum computer in my brain where there's a quantum system that causally mediates, you know, my preferences to my likings, I see no reason to think that a quantum model should be better than the model I just described to you. So anyways, this is my intuition as to why a classical model should do just as well. And so I'm curious whether you agree or disagree.
A classical model, like a probabilistic model with distributions over the preferences?
Yeah.
So interestingly, classical models in the state measurement paradigm, system state measurement paradigm, have not been analyzed so far. So this is a This is quite interesting. The motivation for using quantum models, using that perspective that you mentioned here, is that the classical model, this is an open question now, but there is reason to believe that the classical models are less compressible than the quantum models. So if we believe that there is a good classical model, then it may have to be very, very high dimension and therefore not accessible to inference. So there may be a very good classical model, but it may be too complex to infer practically. So whatever model we fit to the data will necessarily be, if we assume that this is true, then every model we fit to the data will necessarily represent the compression of the classical picture. We can show that quantum models capture the kind of the compressed shadow of classical models. So we can compress classical models into quantum models, and the quantum models present a relaxation of the compression of classical models. So quantum models could be beneficial, or there is some reason to hope that quantum models are beneficial if what you say is correct, in the sense that quantum models realize the compressed shadow, a relaxation of the compressed shadow of classical models. So in the sense that simple quantum models could perform approximately as well as very high dimensional classical models, because they realize the compression of classical models.
But what is the argument that there cannot be a classical model that has, like, reasonably well approximates the quantum one after the compression?
So this is an open question, whether classical models can be compressed as well as quantum models. I have some results in that direction, but it's not fully fleshed out. But it seems plausible that so first of all, it's an open problem how well classical models can be compressed into classical models.
No, I mean actually not. I don't want to compress classical models. I just want to have some not related classical model that would be doing as well as the compressed quantum without having the sort of compression applied to the.
Yes. So if there is a classical model that performs as well as the quantum model, if you have the choice between the classical model and the quantum model, then I think we should go for the classical model because the classical model is better interpreted. Yeah. But so if we take the engineering perspective, then we can just run empirical evaluations and see which one performs better.
Okay.
But there is, I completely agree, you're absolutely right. So there is no rigorous theorem saying quantum models are the best. And deriving such a theorem, such a theorem presumably doesn't exist. And even if it existed, which seems very, very unlikely, it might be horribly hard to prove. But again, if we aim at finding a link between quantum information and what people do in data analysis, then numerical evidence, empirical evidence is sufficient. And actually, these people might care much more about the empirical results than theorems that don't capture precisely the real situation, because these people are very much driven by practical.
There's another point of view of this, the structural point of view, that some computer science data structures can actually be well represented by a specific way of turning quantum mathematical structures used to describe quantum theory. You know, like this monoidal structures in Haskell and so on. So there's also like non-empirical side to this sort of relation.
So presumably all of these algorithms have different parameters, right? Like some numbers that you set that like determine how long it takes, how much memory it uses.
Right. So parameters like stopping criteria,
right.
And dimension. Yep. Yes.
And so how did you choose the parameters for the different?
For the competitors,
yeah.
I just chose the same parameters that they chose in their papers. So this is a valid point, of course. Yeah. So the parameter choices for these models may not be optimal. But these results here are just the results that the authors report in their papers, and they certainly invested quite a lot of time into optimizing these parameters. But it's true. I mean, all of these things. I mean, this is not like mathematical rigorous. This is like empirical hands-on type of things. This is not. We don't have like a rigorous argument for. We cannot conclude from these simple data here that with certainty like one model is better than the other. This is just some observation, and this observation may or may not be.
I wonder, in the context of fitting experimental data, would it be interesting to look at, instead of a minimum dimension model, a minimum weighted dimension in the following sense. So Matt and I have worked with people at IQC at doing this kind of bootstrap tomography on quantum optics experiments. And so there, you don't expect a priori that a two-dimensional model will fit the data exactly because your source isn't single photon. You have some rate of two photons, some rate of three photons, but they're very much smaller. So then you could say, well, all right, I'm going to try to fit it to, you know, 99% probability it's a 2D model, you know, some fraction, 1% probability it's a 3D model, and so on. And then the weighted dimension would just be, you know, the average dimension in that convex mixture. And so I could still have a weighted dimension that was very close to 2 and an extremely good fit because, you know, a lot of the deviations from a perfect two-dimensional model will come from those that mixture of the other models,
so
higher dimension.
Do you, for making predictions, do you take the predictions of the two-dimensional models with like 80% weight and with 20% weight you take the predictions of the three-dimensional models? Is it a weighted prediction in that sense? Or maybe
I'm not saying this is what we do. I'm just thinking that there's an interesting alternative approach to this, which would be to sort of focus on the weighted dimension of your model on the understanding that, you know, you have this probabilistic distribution over different dimensions in a lot of real experiments, and what you're really interested in is making sure that the expected dimension is small, that sort of, you know, most of the data can be explained by having a large component of low dimension.
Things like this are being done. So you have some set of candidate models, and then you want to find like a mixture of models.
Yep.
So once you have like models that kind of seem to perform well, you can kind of boost the performance by combining these models and mixing them up and making weighted predictions.
I guess there are no results like bounds of the type you're talking about for that question.
No. Not that I would.
Questions? Let's thank Cyril.